Seventh, we've dealt thus fully with the recrudescence of scientific studies in the Middle Ages because of its ultimate importance in human affairs. In the long run, Roger Bacon is of more significance to mankind than any monarch of his time. But the contemporary world, for the most part, knew nothing of this smouldering activity in studies and lecture rooms and alchemists' laboratories that was presently to alter all the conditions of life. The Church did indeed take notice of what was afoot, but only because of the disregard of her conclusive decisions. She had decided that the earth was the very centre of God's creation, and that the Pope was the divinely appointed ruler of the earth. Men's ideas on these essential points, she insisted, mustn't be disturbed by any contrary teaching. So soon, however, as she had compelled Galileo to say that the world did not move, she was satisfied. She doesn't seem to have realized how ominous it was for her that, after all, the earth did move. Very great social as well as intellectual developments were in progress in Western Europe throughout this period of the later Middle Ages. But the human mind apprehends events far more vividly than changes, and men, for the most part, then as now, kept on in their own traditions in spite of the shifting scene about them. In an outline such as this, it's impossible to crowd in the clustering events of history that don't clearly show the main process of human development, however bright and picturesque they may be. We have to record the steady growth of towns and cities, the reviving power of trade and money, the gradual re-establishment of law and custom, the extension of security, the supersession of private warfare that went on in Western Europe in the period between the First Crusade and the 16th century. Of much that looms large in our national histories, we can't tell anything. We have no space for the story of the repeated attempts of the English kings to conquer Scotland and set themselves up as kings of France, nor of how the Norman English established themselves insecurely in Ireland in the 12th century, and how Wales was linked to the English crown in 1282. All through the Middle Ages, the struggle of England with Scotland and France was in progress. There were times when it seemed that Scotland was finally subjugated, and when the English king held far more land in France than its titular sovereign. In the English histories, this struggle with France is too often represented as a single-handed and almost successful attempt to conquer France. In reality, it was a joint enterprise, undertaken in concert, first with the Flemings and Bavarians, and afterwards with the powerful French vassal state of Burgundy, to conquer and divide the patrimony of Hugh Capet. Of the English rout by the Scotch at Bannockburn in 1314, and of William Wallace and Robert the Bruce, the Scottish national heroes, of the battles of Crecy in 1346, and Poitiers in 1356, and Agincourt in 1415 in France, which shine like stars in the English imagination, little battles in which sturdy bowmen through some sunny hours made a great havoc among French knights in armour, of the Black Prince and Henry V of England, and of how a peasant girl, Joan of Arc, the Maid of Orléans, drove the English out of her country again in 1429 to 1430. This history relates nothing. For every country has such cherished national events. They're the ornamental tapestry of history, and no part of the building, Rajputana or Poland, Russia, Spain, Persia, and China, can all match or outdo the utmost romance of Western Europe with equally adventurous knights and equally valiant princesses and equally stout fights against the odds. Nor can we tell how Louis XI of France, 1461 to 1483, the son of Joan of Arc's Charles VII, brought Burgundy to heel and laid the foundations of a centralized French monarchy. It signifies more that in the 13th and 14th centuries, gunpowder, that Mongol gift, came to Europe, so that the kings, Louis XI included, and the law, relying upon the support of the growing towns, were able to batter down the castles of the half-independent robber knights and barons of the earlier Middle Ages, and consolidate a more centralized power. The fighting nobles and knights of the barbaric period disappear slowly from this history during these centuries. The Crusades consumed them. Such dynastic wars as the English Wars of the Roses killed them off. The arrows from the English longbow pierced them and stuck out a yard behind. Infantry so armed swept them from the stricken field. They became reconciled to trade and changed their nature. They disappeared in everything but a titular sense from the west and south of Europe before they disappeared from Germany. The knight in Germany remained a professional fighting man into the 16th century. Between the 11th and the 15th centuries in Western Europe, and particularly in France and England, there sprang up, like flowers, a multitude of very distinctive and beautiful buildings. Cathedrals, abbeys, and the like, the Gothic architecture. This lovely efflorescence marks the appearance of a body of craftsmen closely linked in its beginnings to the church. In Italy and Spain, too, the world was beginning to build freely and beautifully again. At first it was the wealth of the church that provided most of these buildings. Then kings and merchants also began to build. From the 12th century onward, with the increase of trade, there was a great revival of town life throughout Europe. Prominent among these towns were Venice, with its dependents Ragusa and Corfu, Genoa, Verona, Bologna, Pisa, Florence, Naples, Milan, Marseille, Lisbon, Barcelona, Narbonne, Tours, Orléans, Bordeaux, Paris, Ghent, Bruges, Boulogne, London, Oxford, Cambridge, Southampton, Dover, Antwerp, Hamburg, Bremen, Cologne, Mayence, Nuremberg, Munich, Leipzig, Magdeburg, Breslau, Stettin, Danzig, Königsberg, Riga, Pskov, Novgorod, Visby, and Bergen. A West German town between 1400 and 1500 embodied all the achievements of progress at that time, although from a modern standpoint much seems wanting. The streets were mostly narrow and irregularly built, the houses chiefly of wood, while almost every burgher kept his cattle in the house, and the herd of swine, which was driven every morning by the town herdsmen to the pasture ground, formed an inevitable part of city life. In Frankfurt on Main, it was unlawful after 1481 to keep swine in the Altstadt, but in the Neustadt and in Sachsenhausen this custom remained as a matter of course. It was only in 1645, after a corresponding attempt in 1556 had failed, that the swine pens in the inner town were pulled down at Leipzig. The rich burghers who occasionally took part in the great trading companies were conspicuously wealthy landowners and had extensive courtyards with large barns inside the town walls. The most opulent of them owned those splendid patrician houses which we still admire even today. But even in the older towns, most houses of the 15th century have disappeared. Only here and there a building with open timberwork and overhanging stories, as in Bacharach or Miltenburg, reminds us of the style of architecture then customary in the houses of burghers. The great bulk of the inferior population who lived on mendicancy or got a livelihood by the exercise of the inferior industries inhabited squalid hovels outside the town. The town wall was often the only support for these wretched buildings. The internal fittings of the houses, even amongst the wealthy population, were very defective according to modern ideas. The Gothic style was as little suitable for the petty details of objects of luxury as it was splendidly adapted for the building of churches and town halls. The influence of the Renaissance added much to the comfort of the house.